Yeah, but in any case, it was, there was nothing, he basically conceived of the idea and put an awful lot of it in the place before, I would say, I ever came here. And so now he's just came back from holiday and can see that everything that it's all pretty well come to fruition. So he'd like to say a few words to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. So, yeah, as John said, I only started myself a promoter last October and had this crazy idea for a very innovative new graduate course on theoretical physics. And coming to Groton was a chance to actually implement it. There were a few sort of tense moments in October where we wondered, will we actually be able to do this next summer? And one of the things that made it possible was hiring John. We were really fortunate to find him at a point where he could do this. Things just fell into place very, very quickly. And this is sort of characteristic of Perimeter. Perimeter is very new, and we have amazing resources and amazing freedom. And all of us at Perimeter should take advantage of that. But of course, it's also something, it's a responsibility to use that freedom well. And make sure Perimeter really lives up to its potential. So I just wanted to say a few things, and I don't want to I want to minimize the distraction from Lima's lecture. I want to say just a couple of things. Perimeter is very new, as you can see, and expanding rapidly. The goal of Perimeter is to create the best possible environment for theoretical physics research. Full stop. That's the goal. And even that is a sort of subsidiary goal. The real goal is to promote new breakthroughs in our understanding of quantum theory, or the laws of physics, and space-time, the arena of physics. And that's why Perimeter was established. And aside from that, we have almost no constraint. Okay. And so this is it's a very open-ended project. And it will be as successful as we make it. So it's really an incredible opportunity. The key to its success will be that it has to be innovative. There's no point just replicating everyone else's doing it because they're doing it already. And it has to be responsive, very responsive. So when there are new opportunities, we must respond quickly. When we do something wrong, we must respond very quickly to correct it. And basically, the whole spirit of the Institute is to try things out, to learn as we do that, and to adapt and improve. So where does Psi fit in? Well, for me, Psi is fundamental to the whole enterprise, because theoretical physics rests above all on the entry of brilliant young people like all of you into the field to question the things we take for granted and to see things we have missed and to bring about change and advancement in the subject. So for me, a stream of brilliant young people coming through Perimeter is the key to the success. So you're really extremely important people, okay? There may be some VIPs visiting Perimeter from time to time, like Mike Lazaridis, who founded Perimeter with this incredible donation. Canadian government people, like the one I brought last Friday to see your lectures. And by the way, he was extremely impressed. I think we just walked in the room and you could feel the atmosphere. It was pretty exciting. And so he went away very happy with the Canadian government's investment. So there are all these VIPs coming through, but I think you're the EIPs, which means extremely important. and so, you know, Perimeter is here to make your lives rewarding to help you become theoretical physicists. PSI is a pilot program. This year is the pilot of the main program. It's an experiment, like everything else at Perimeter. It's an experiment in theory, if you like, and we have to learn. So we actually need your advice, we need your input, what's working, what isn't working. Don't expect to just come to me or John and say, you know, I want X, and X will appear. That's not the way it works. We have a lot of critical thinking in Perimeter. So if someone has an idea or proposal, first thing we try to do is to shoot it down, okay? And find the flaws in it and see the problems and are you wasting money? Yeah, that's a big obsession of mine. We cannot afford to waste a penny. And we have money, but we've got to spend it very, very, very well. And so don't expect a free lunch. No, you'll get some free lunch. And PSI will grow. We're 28 this year, and we're especially delighted that, where is our student who just came? Oh, there she is. I'm sorry, what is your name? Yes.
My name is Vin.
Vin just arrived from Vietnam, and we have one more student coming from Cuba, we hope. He's still struggling with the visa problem. But we were really thrilled at the applicants to PSI. That we launched this in, when was it, early December. The website went up, and we got 230 applications, and John had a lot of sleepless nights working through the applications, so many of the faculty were involved, and we were really thrilled with the quality and quality of the students who applied, and so we really want to welcome you here. Lots of things are happening at Perimeter. You see a new building going up. The Canadian government has just given us a grant of $23 million for an expansion of Perimeter, which will double the size of the institute and actually treble the number of researchers at Perimeter. Currently it's about 85 and it will go up to about 250, including PSI students. And they will, the PSI program will grow to 50. So currently 28 as the pilot, but it will increase, and 2 years from now it will all be in that new building. In fact, front and center of the new building is the PSI facility, specially designed, I mentioned the itinerant workspace and so on. So it'll be pretty exciting, and you are the people who will help us design this to really be optimal. So as well as the building, of course, is nothing. Anyone can make a building. Actually, it's really, if you look at the way they
make core materials in the morning.
If you look at how they're making the building, it's astonishingly crude, right? They take these steel pins and they just bash it into the ground, and who knows what's under there? Maybe some big hole full of water.
It really is a good template for creative thought. They don't go into something every single time of the past 100 years.
But it works. We have. So we'll have a new building, and this will be one of the largest, if not the largest, institute in the world devoted to theoretical physics. So you're again very important because you're going to help us design this new facility and what happens inside it in the optimal way. So as I said, the building's not the important thing. What's important is what happens inside the building. And lots of new things are happening in that respect, too. As you know, you probably know from the website. Please keep looking at the website. It's a problem for us that you're over here, because you're a little bit away from the main facility. It was just because we didn't have space to put you there. But keep looking at the website, look at all the talks. Look at all the visitors who are coming through. We've got a wonderful program of visitors, especially, for example, the Distinguished Research Chairs, of which Nima is one.
and a number of these people coming through, and several will be teaching on science. So next month, for example, Danny Susskind will be here for the month. Leo Kadanoff is coming to teach on Psy, and he's going to be here for a period. Maybe some of you met him when he was here in August. Yes, good. So I know he, and one of the really surprising and gratifying things about organizing Psy was the way in which the whole world of theoretical physics responded positively. Okay, so really famous, brilliant theoretical physicist, you know, who I didn't know, called them up, told them about Psy, and they were keen, very keen to come and teach, come and meet the students. I think this is something common across the field, that one of the biggest thrills, you know, a senior theoretical physicist has is to interact with students who are just learning. And it's entirely selfishness, okay? Because they know that you will look at things differently and you may ask a good question. And yeah, good questions are very important to making progress. Other people are coming. Zhao Jian Wen is also going to lecture you. And then, of course, we have the colloquia and public lectures. There's a whole ton of things which you will not be able to go to. Too many things for you to go to. But be selective and come over to PI whenever you can and meet these people. And you know, be brave. Just go up and introduce yourselves. Don't be, and if you feel shy, then come and get me or John, you know, to introduce you, because it's very important and they will enjoy it. Now, we have got five patrons of Psy, as you know: Stephen Hawking, Phil Anderson, Jim Peebles, Yakir Avramov, and BJ Bjorke. And so they will be visiting during the course of the year. These are very, very renowned physicists, and they've agreed to come and spend some time here and just chat to you about their own experience of theoretical physics and hopefully give you some ideas about what, you know, the kind of thing you might do with your career. So I only want to give you one little piece of advice. Okay. Actually, the zero piece of advice is don't take any advice, because everybody's unique and we all see things differently. But the one piece of advice I would give you is that your most important asset is your enthusiasm. Okay? Don't lose it. Be very protective of your enthusiasm. In other words, think you're stressing out, too much work, whatever, and it's detracting from your enthusiasm, then take a break. Your enthusiasm is the single most important asset you have. Keep feeding it, okay, by doing the things you love to do. And if you do that, you'll be successful. So keep your enthusiasm alive. Take a break from physics. One of the mistakes we have undoubtedly made with Psy is to put too much in. Okay. So I'm sure there will be too much in this program, and that means you have to take a break. It's not a competitive program at all. It's designed so that each one of you will maximize your own potential and find what you're interested in and do your own thing. Okay, this is not a competitive program anyway. And but do take a break from time to time. Waterloo is not New York, in case you haven't noticed. But there are a few things here which are fun. I'm old, so I won't have the same interest as you, but there are a few nice things. There's an art cinema here, The Princess, with two screens, and they do show pretty good films. And we're going to buy you all memberships to that cinema so that you get cheap tickets. And I do encourage you to go and see films whenever you can. Okay, they're really good films, I'm sure. Second thing is there is north of what claims to be, many claims, okay, about Waterloo. One of which is that Waterloo claims to have the North America's most active chamber music society. Okay. And what does that mean? It means they have two or three concerts per week. actually held in the front room of somebody's home. Very interesting, because very big front room. And absolutely brilliant program of classical chamber music concerts, and it's just 200 meters from here. And again, we're going to cut a deal with them to give you half price tickets. That will be two or three times a week if you can see some really wonderful chamber music. But then I just wanted to ask you all, I know everybody has different tastes, and so you all just think between you, what's the kind of thing you like, what might you want to do. There is Stratford, which again claims to be North America's largest theater festival. And that's 45 minutes drive from here, but we can arrange a bus for you to go to that. Wonderful, you know, Shakespeare, Oscar Wilde, all kinds of classical theater, as well as some modern stuff. And Stratford is a really beautiful little town around a lake. So these are any suggestions. Talk amongst yourselves. Think what you know what you'd like to do for an outing. And I'm very, very sympathetic to the idea. We need a break. And and Canada, of course, is a magnificent country. The reason I'm late is we were touring some of the more remote areas in Canada. Horse riding and sea kayaking, and there's some pretty wonderful things you can do in Canada. But so anyway, encourage you to think about that. We'll try and make your time here as enjoyable and rewarding as possible. So now, without further waste of time, I want to introduce Nima. Nima is, as you probably know, one of the world's leading theoretical physicists who tries to connect fundamental theory to experimental predictions. And this is actually a very rare skill. You find people who are very mathematical and can simply develop a theory. You find people who are very phenomenological and just fit the theory to data. Nima spans the divide, which is obviously vital, and he has an extremely distinguished career, Stanford, Harvard, Princeton Institute for Advanced Study. But of course, his greatest distinction is that he visits the spirometer very regularly, and we hope increasingly regularly, again, it was really a thrill to find that Nima agreed to, I think he was one of the first lecturers I invited, and he immediately agreed to give the opening course on theory in this program. So, let me just welcome Nima.
Just a few ground rules. Call me Nima. Feel free to interrupt at any time. So you know this week of lectures, especially this set of lectures. I mean, I have to say, when Neil asked me to lecture, I said sure. Then I got the title of the lectures was research skills. What is it exactly? It's research. I thought, what the heck is this? You know, other people get respectable sounding names like quantum field theory, standard model, general relativity. I get research skills. You know, I don't know what research skills are. We'll have to make something up. So I think precisely because of that, I'm kidding, John. I'm kidding. I do know what research skills are, at least a few of them. But precisely because that's what the topic is, it's going to be even more conversational and more interactive than a typical set of lectures like this should be, which should already be fairly conversational and interactive. So feel free to interrupt at any time. Really, actually, this lecture, to begin with, I'd just like to get a somewhat better idea of what's in everyone's heads, the sorts of things you're interested in, and I'll tailor what we talk about a little bit. I mean, I have some grand plan in mind, but it's flexible. So let me just ask a few very, very general questions. So what fraction of you people are interested? So you're all interested in theoretical physics, so we'll just put up our hands. So theoretical physics, yes. Very good. Not you, Neil. You're exempt from this. Actually, maybe I'll ask a very interesting question. Okay, so what fraction of you are interested in what fraction of you think you know what area you're interested in already? What subpart of theoretical physics? Very good. All right. Excellent. Shame on all of you. No, I'm kidding. All right. So that obviates a lot of my other questions. So it's very good. Just one. What fraction of you might be interested in things like condensed matter or things that you might be interested in condensed? Okay, that's fine. We'll talk to you later. Okay, very good. Now, what fraction of you have had some introduction to? I'm just trying to get some idea of background. If I write down eight mu nu on the blackboard, how many people are happy with that symbol? Yeah, thank you. Yes. yes, it is a flat metric. Yes. Okay. What fraction of you, so you've all had some exposure to quantum mechanics, I presume. How many of you have had any exposure to GR? Okay, that's fine. Not necessary. I'm really just trying to get an idea of background. So don't. One of the things that you'll discover very quickly, very, very quickly in this business, I have a bunch of platitudes to say, which I'll intersperse throughout this first lecture. But one of the things that you'll discover very quickly is that your initial level of preparation as undergraduates matters very, very little. Okay? You should think of grad school as a big vat of molasses, huge big vat of molasses, and your bullets fired with differing velocities into this big vat of molasses. You can be fired with greater initial velocity or less initial velocity, but you will come to a rest in this vat of molasses somewhere. Okay? All right? And the fun starts when you have to figure out how to get out and not suffocate and drown and get sticky. Okay? So it really, the initial level of preparation, I really want to emphasize this point, because it's something I dimly recall at this level. It's been so long now, but I dimly recall being concerned about this and saying, oh, some people go to, you know, famous school X and Y and worked with famous person Z, and I did not. This does not matter. I mean, you have no idea how babyish you are right now, okay? And at what an early stage of development you are, and your entire intellectual lives are ahead of you. So where you're beginning, what initial velocities are coming to this really doesn't matter. And I'm not kidding. This is not, I promise not to be politically correct in what I tell you. I will tell you uncomfortable truths in this series of lectures, and there are uncomfortable truths about this business. So you can, but I will be honest about everything, and this is one thing which is definitely true. Okay, so do not worry about where you come from. These questions are really meant to figure out what kind of common language I can use for the rest of the lecture. So some exposure to GR, not much. Everyone's happy with quantum mechanics. Everyone's happy with special relativity. Sorry? Happy. Well, okay. Okay. You will become happy in the course of your lives. Okay. So I'm supposed to tell you about research skills. Let me begin by tying my shoes, otherwise you won't take anything I say seriously. So in order to tell you about research skills, I think we have to begin with from the beginning, and actually have to talk about what there is to research. Okay? What's the whole point? So that's what I want to do today. I want to spend some time today just telling you about what the grand sweep of problems are that we face in fundamental physics. One of the wonderful things about this business is that the really fundamental problems are relatively simple to state. They're relatively simple to state. They're relatively simple to talk about and to characterize. It's a remarkable thing that some of the questions that people started thinking about 2,000 years ago, the intervening 2,000 years, have brought to a place where you can actually work on them. And it's a meaningful thing to work on them. And they've been sharpened to the point where you can work on them. This is one of the, if I have to say what the really overarching research skill is, a thing that really cannot be actually taught, but has to be experienced and has to be gone through a number of times. Is this process of taking very vague, big ideas and turning them into sharp questions that you can actually work on. Okay, that's the greatest skill of all. And that's something that I will try to give you some flavor of towards the latter part of the course. But anyway, that's of the lectures. But that is where we are today. Some of the truly fundamental problems are things that you can actually work on. So that's the really good news. I'm going to start by telling you a lot of good news. And then I'll tell you what some of the bad news is at the end of the lecture. So let's start by just talking about, there's many ways of organizing this, but let's start by just talking about all the length scales that we've seen in the universe so far. So I'm going to start at the biggest length scale and go to the smallest length scales that we have seen. So the biggest length scale is around the size of the observable universe, is around 10 to the 28 centimeters. So this is the size of the observable universe. The smallest length scale that we've probed, actually the length scale that we're about to probe this year, starting in November, when the Large Hadron Collider turns on, is around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. Okay. So everything we know of in nature that we've observed takes place somewhere in this however many orders of magnitude it is. What's 28 plus 17? Let's see, 38, 45. These 40, did I do that right? Yes, okay. Everything that we've seen in nature takes place somewhere in this 45 orders of magnitude. That's not very many decades between the largest scales and the smallest scales. Of course, one of the lovely things is that almost every one of those decades has something remarkable associated with it, some beautiful physical phenomenon, some incredible fact. So if we populate some of them, you know, around a million times smaller than the universe are galaxies. 10 to the 22 centimeters is the size of galaxies. I'm going to start running out. I did this badly, didn't I? Anyway, well, this is not quite a uniform scale. We have things like the solar system. The solar system is around 10 to the 13 centimeters. The Earth-Sun distance is around 10 to the 13 centimeters. People. Right? So we're about 100 centimeters. Atoms. Atoms are around 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. Nuclei, the proton and the neutron, are around the size of the proton and the neutron is around 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. And so we've gone to around, as I said, we've gone to around, with accelerator experiments, so far, we've gone down to around 100 times smaller than the proton, so around 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. And where we're about to go to with the LHC is around 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, so around 1,000 times smaller than the proton and the neutron. Okay. So that's LHC. There's one experimental frontier. Here is that distance scale is the Hubble scale. That obviously has physical significance. That's the size of the observable universe. There's a ton of experiments that are going that are have already probed what's going on at very, very large scales. So we'll talk a little bit more about them. We're about to go here, as I said, starting in a few months. Actually, this distance scale that we're about to go to has has its own invariant significance. It isn't just interesting because it happens to be the frontier of what we've explored. It is the frontier of what we've explored. But it has its own invariant significance. It's also called the electroweak length scale. And I'll talk a little bit more about it later. But I just want to say that people have known about the existence of this length scale. People have known that something is going on here for around 70 years, maybe almost 80 years. Okay? They've known that something is up, something interesting is going on here. So it's actually very exciting that we're about to probe this distance scale that we've known something is up with for a very long time is what we're about to probe now. Okay. So this there's as you see, there's lots and lots going on. Now, what's wonderful is that we actually have a perfectly good theory that, in principle, explains everything that's taking place between here and here. Okay? If we take the known laws of gravity, the Newtonian laws of gravity is very importantly updated by Einstein, so general relativity and quantum mechanics combined with special relativity turned out to be very, very hard. It's not so easy to combine quantum mechanics and even special relativity together. But there emerged in the 20th century this theoretical framework that allows us to talk about quantum mechanics and special relativity together. That framework is called quantum field theory. And it was discovered that a particular quantum field theory describes our world. And that particular quantum field theory is known as the standard model of particles. Okay. So, in principle, the standard model plus general relativity can really explain all the phenomenon that that go on between here and there. And I'm deliberately not going all the way because there's truly fundamental mysteries associated with what's happening right at the boundaries. Okay. Now, in fact, in order to talk about what those mysteries are, so and we're going to come back. In tomorrow, we're going to talk a lot about what's happening in between. Part of the theme of my lectures is going to be that all of fundamental physics is seamlessly connected one part to another, okay? And that your real job as a theoretical physicist is to understand this and to really understand on a large scale how the entire universe works. That means whatever your specialty is, whatever area you start in, whatever you're doing, it's a very long project, it's a very long process, so you have to start somewhere. But your ultimate goal is to understand everything, is to be able to give an explanation for everything. And in order to do that, you really need to become comfortable not just with what's going on at the cutting edge, but at a broad brush level with everything that's taking place throughout the universe. We're going to spend quite a bit of time in these lectures doing that, going over how you can understand just at your fingertips any gross question you ask about the world. You know, why is the sun the temperature it is or the size it is? What is the hardness of materials? Why is the velocity of sound 300 kilometers a second? All of these things, all these disconnected facts, all follow from a few fundamental constants and from fundamental physics. Okay? And there's just a picture in your head that you should be carrying of the universe as we understand it. And you have to fill in that picture and understand it and be comfortable in it and be able to walk around the length scales, starting at the Hubble scale, go down to the shortest scales, back up. You really have to get to know the world as your playground. Okay? Part of what we're going to do, this is not the sort of thing which is taught. to you as undergraduates. But it's part of the vernacular of theoretical physics. It's part of what you really have to be able to understand and do. Think parametrically, understand how things relate to fundamental constants, understand how basic physical laws explain everything. Okay? That doesn't mean you have to understand everything in its finest details, but at a broad brush, you should be able to explain everything. And we're going to talk about that. That's going to be a lot of the actual physics content of my lectures. But for today, for this introduction, I'm going to erase everything in between, as in principle understood. Okay? Right? This is where we sometimes get in trouble with our colleagues from other subjects. But it's really, and I'm going to put that scale here, the electroweak scale here, because we're going to talk about one more scale. Oops. And that's where we're about to go to with the LHC. All right. There's one more length scale, which is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. This is the Planck length. Okay. And this is a length scale, as we'll review in a second. This is a length scale that's associated with gravity. Okay. So you'll notice one thing about it right away. It's 16 orders of magnitude smaller than any length scale that we've probed experimentally. Okay? However, it's the answer to the following question. And there's many ways of saying it, and we'll review it in many ways in a second. But one way of characterizing it is it's the scale at which the strength of gravity catches up with the strength of all the other interactions. Now you might ask, what does that mean? Let's say I take two electrons. Okay? If I take two electrons, then the gravitational force between them, this is probably something many of you have done many times, the gravitational attraction between them is 42 orders of magnitude weaker than the electric repulsion. Okay? So the reason why gravity seems to be an important force in daily life is simply that we're mostly electrically neutral. Right? We're mostly electrically neutral, made out of atoms. Atoms are electrically neutral. And so the leading electromagnetic force between two objects vanishes. Okay? Actually, gravity is so weak, and that's why gravity dominates. Okay? Gravity is so weak that you can ask the following question. Even let's take two neutral atoms. Let's say you take two hydrogen atoms. Okay? Hydrogen atom there, hydrogen atom there. Now, what is the leading force between these two hydrogen atoms? Do you know? Right. So but what is the physical origin of this force? Does it have a name, or do you know what the... It's called the van der Waals force. Okay? And where does this force come from? This force comes from the fact that we have this proton, we have the electron whizzing around it. I have another proton, another electron. And it comes from the fact that, of course, the hydrogen atom doesn't have any net dipole moment. This guy doesn't have any net dipole moment. But every now and then, this electron will be over here, and it, you know, and it will polarize that electron to be, it comes from a very indirect effect that we can quantify a little of the mutual polarization of these two guys in the presence of each other. Okay? So that gives rise to a very weak force that goes like 1/r^6. Okay? The potential goes like 1/r^6. But you can ask, at what distance does that become comparable to gravity? And it's at about 1 millimeter. Okay? So if you take two hydrogen atoms 1 millimeter apart, already this extremely, very, very indirect electromagnetic force is already as strong as gravity. Okay? Then it takes off like 1/r^6, then it totally swamps gravity at shorter distances. Okay? One of the things that you will be able to do if you don't know how to do it already by the end of these lectures is estimate in a few squiggles why that's 1/r^6, why that length scale is 1 millimeter, and all of those things. Okay, this is part of the set of things that you should be able to do on the back of an envelope as a professional practicing physicist that, again, we'll talk about. But anyway, at the moment, I just want to tell you that's how weak gravity is. Okay, that even this horrendously indirect electromagnetic effect beats gravity already at macroscopic distances of about a millimeter. So when people say gravity is the strongest force macroscopically, there is a quantitative length scale associated with that at distances larger than a millimeter. Okay? At distances larger than a millimeter, gravity is the strongest force. Gravity is the strongest force there is because the neutral interaction between everything is weaker. Okay. Of course, if there's any kind of dipole moment here at all, a magnetic dipole moment, electric dipole moment, forget it. Those things totally dominate. Okay? And that's why a little teeny tiny fridge magnet can pick up a pin off a table, even though the entire mass of the Earth is tugging on it. Okay? So there are even strong interactions, but this is the dead weakest possible electromagnetic interaction that you could have, and even that is stronger than gravity. So it's really true. Gravity is a horrendously tiny force. Now, however, you might think, well, the ratio of the gravitational force to the electromagnetic force is a constant, independent of distance, because they both scale like 1 over r squared, right? So you say, if I look at the ratio of the strength of gravity to electromagnetism between two electrons, it'll always be 10 to the minus 42, because it's gmm over r squared compared to e squared over r squared. Okay? But the r squareds cancel out. However, that's not quite true. And the reason has to do with the uncertainty principle. When you get the electrons close enough, at some point, they start getting lots of uncertainty principle momentum. So if you're going to actually get them close enough, you're going to have to put some energy into the system in order to keep them there. Okay? And as you put them closer and closer to each other, that happens more and more. Okay? Now, the relevant length scale where that first starts happening is the Compton wavelength of the electron. So when you get to distances shorter compared to the Compton wavelength of the electron, the system starts becoming very relativistic. Okay? And so you start getting more and more energy. In order to be able to put them at closer and closer distances, you get more and more energy. Okay? So at that point, because gravity couples to mass and energy, the gravitational force starts taking off and getting bigger. Okay? Whereas the electromagnetic force is staying the same. So there is finally some length scale at which the gravitational force catches up and becomes comparable to everything else. And that length scale turns out to be around 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Okay, so we'll review all of this properly in a bit, but just so I can get a very broad story out first. So there's many ways of saying what's special about the scale, and this is one of them. This is a scale at which gravity catches up in strength with all the other interactions. Everything with the scale, the word is gravity. Okay? So it's also the length scale at which the quantum fluctuations, you know, gravity has to do with fluctuations in space-time. It's also the scale where the quantum fluctuations in space-time become very large. Okay? So so this is the place where gravity becomes strong, and the words quantum mechanics and gravity used in the same sentence start, if you're going to say the word quantum mechanics, you have to say the word gravity and vice versa. Okay, so they have to start being treated simultaneously at this length scale. Okay? Now, so here are three important length scales. This one is theoretically inferred from one of these arguments that I said. These two have been experimentally probed. And the remarkable thing is that even though we understand an enormous amount about the universe, and our understanding has greatly sharpened the things that we can say confidently and the things that we are still murky about, we have arrived here in the beginning of the 21st century to another one of the periods in the history of physics where there are exceedingly simple questions with clearly crazy answers. Okay? And every time this happens, that means that there are seeds for a revolution. This does not happen all the time. So this is really, it's not a rah-rah speech. This could not have been said in the year 1940. It couldn't have been said in the year 1970. Okay? It could have been said in the year 1900, even though it wasn't. But there's a few times in the history of physics where this sort of thing happens, and we're really at one of them. I think this is really a fair statement. Okay? And there isn't just one or two mysteries, but there aren't infinitely many of them either. And in fact, almost all of them are associated with the three scales that I'm talking about here. Okay? Every one of these scales is associated with a very important crisis in our understanding of physical theory. Okay? Now, this is something that you should learn to love, especially if you're young. Okay? Crises in theoretical physics are wonderful news. Okay? They're wonderful news because we understand things so well that we have very tight theoretical structures. And every time there is a crisis, it tells you something specific that has to be changed. It isn't some throw the whole thing out, start all over again. You know, that's never what revolutions are like in our field. This is one of the misconceptions that if you have it, you should get it out of your head quickly. Probably not since Ptolemy have we been completely wrong about something. And even Ptolemy wasn't totally wrong about it. But certainly not in the last 400 years has some body of knowledge just been completely wrong. Okay? Revolutions have never been by some left out of the, totally out of the left field person who, you know, studied Eastern mysticism for their entire life and they came in and said what you're doing in physics is totally wrong. That's never been the way it's like. In fact, the great revolutions, especially the revolutions of just even looking back, relativity and quantum mechanics, had both fundamentally conservative and a radical element to them. That's what makes life hard. That's what makes it interesting. If all you had to do to push things forward was just be radical all the time, well, then we'd go culling radical people from, we'd teach people how to be radical all the time, right? But that's not, unfortunately, true, right? It's not just radicalism, nor is it just conservatism. That we could do pretty easily, okay? The trick is to figure out how to be both. That's really hard. It's really hard to know what to be radical about and what to be conservative about at any time. But it is never true that you just chuck everything. Okay? It's, in fact, much more often true that you have to take the important theoretical insights that you've gotten and take them more seriously than you did before and not less seriously. Figure out how to put them together. Figure out how things that don't seem to want to fit can fit and yet still all be right. Okay? So this is a real challenge. Contrary to a lot of public misconception, Einstein was not a truly revolutionary physicist in that sense. He was extremely conservative about some very important principles and held on to them when other people were willing to give them up. Okay? And many similar things happened in the discovery of quantum mechanics. It was a real back and forth between conservatism and radicalism. I tell you these things about history partially as an aside, to encourage you to learn something about the history of theoretical physics. This is not so you can copy it. Hardly anything will ever happen twice in the same way. But because that's going to be part of your culture. You know, you're entering a culture that's existed for hundreds of years with a wonderful history that's been kept, and there's an oral tradition, there's a written tradition, and you should become steeped in all of it. Okay? These are your people now, so you should get to know them. But also to say that when I tell you there are crises, it does not mean, oh, great, I don't have to listen to anything about what these old farts have to say. I'm just going to go solve these problems myself. Look, this is what they did. They took this beautiful subject and they brought it to a crisis. Okay? That's not what I'm saying. You really have to learn what has come before. But keep in mind that the things that have to be solved have a big element to them. And the big elements are clues for what the solution should look like. So it's a wonderful thing, which I'm exploiting, that it's possible to talk about what the problems are without a huge amount of background. Okay, that's a real characteristic of really excellent problems, is that they're simple to state, clear, huge, big problems. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. I will state them and tell you what they are, but it's going to take you some number of years and standard. And hard work in order to be able to start attacking them. But I want to tell you what they are as a motivation for the blood and sweat and tears that you will be enduring for the next little while. All right. So every one of these scales is associated with a crisis, and now I'm going to tell you what they are. Okay. In order to put the proceedings in order to get going in the most exciting possible way, I want to start talking about units. Just to bring things down a notch before we crank them up again. Okay. This is perhaps the most important thing you'll get out of this lecture, if not out of this entire lecture series. Okay? And I'm not kidding. Okay. Hands up if you prefer the MKS system. Hands up if you prefer the CGS system. Well, that's very good. How many of you are perfectly happy with natural units? Beautiful, because I was going to like say you suck completely if you like either MKS or CGS, okay? You should talk about natural units, okay? So we're going to review. Now, this is the sort of thing you see in lectures all the time. People will say, I work in units where h bar equals c equals 1, right? And then off they go. And I just want to review what this means precisely, okay? It could be simple. One of the number one rules in this business is to ask, not only not to be afraid to ask dumb questions, but to ask yourself dumb questions all the time. There's a second rule, which people don't emphasize so much. You see, I told you that I would not just tell you politically correct platitudes. It's true that you should ask dumb questions. But you should ask lots of them and try to answer them as quickly as possible. Okay? It's really the number one path to progress in learning any new subject is to walk in and ask the simplest questions first, the dumbest questions first. But don't just sit around saying, oh, that's such a nice question. It's a great question. You know, you're only going to learn by asking dumb questions. But you know, in the end, the thing that you're trying to learn is fairly sophisticated. So you need to answer them and get them answered as quickly as possible. Move on to the next dumb question and the next dumb question. Before you know it, you're asking decent questions. But it's not enough to ask dumb questions. Dumb questions are certainly fine, and you should ask, but you should learn to ask lots of them and get them answered as quickly as possible. Okay? So what do we mean by working in these units? Let me contrast working in these units with working in the units that we're familiar with, like meters, kilograms, seconds, whatever. So in order to do this, let's say something very, very, very obvious but very important. Nothing in physics has units. No actual observable has units. Okay. When I say that, you know, this blackboard is a meter, 2 meters, whatever tall, 1.5 meters tall, what am I really saying? Everything has a dimensionless answer. Okay. What I'm really saying is that the ratio of the height of this blackboard to some bar hanging in Paris is 1.5. Okay? That's what I really mean. So it's perfectly dimensionless. It's just that because of these guys in Paris, we keep referring everything to some stupid ratio of the length of that bar. I don't know who gives a rat's ass about it. Okay? All right? So here's a much more useful way, or a kilogram. I don't even know where the kilogram is stored. Does anyone know? I don't know. Paris as well? Everything is in Paris? Wow. The second is in Paris as well? I could spend longer than a second in Paris, yeah. But there's a much more invariant and better way of talking about things. Instead of saying what is the height of the blackboard units of that meter bar, which is very human-oriented and very Parisian-oriented and so on, right? Wouldn't it be more useful to say, how high is this blackboard in units of the size of an atom? That would tell you something right away, right? If you knew that number, it would not only tell you the same information, but it would tell you how many atoms you can stack one on top of each other to get there. Okay. That's the point of using natural units. Okay, we're going to use natural units so that everything, all the dimensionless ratios that we're talking about, can very easily be translated to something that's actually natural. Okay, the units will be in units of some actual physical attribute of nature, and not some random anthropomorphic construct. Okay. Now the reason we put h bar and c to 1. Is because of a fact about the laws of nature. This is why Planck in 1900 got excited about these his constant and introduced this whole idea of natural units, because they tell us that they tell us about some. They reduce the number of. They allow us to reduce everything to dimensionless ratios using quantities that are actually parts of nature. Okay. So putting C equal to 1, what do I mean when I say C equals 1? It means that I will measure distances in units of light seconds. Okay? So so I can say that before you knew that the speed of light was a constant and an important constant of nature, I could characterize the length of the table by giving a length or how long it took, I don't know, or how long it took to fire a cannonball across it. Okay? But that would still have a measure of arbitrary in a synaptic, because someone else could come along and fire the cannonball with a different speed. Right? But the fact that there's this universal constant, the speed of light, means that I can measure the length of the table. Instead of giving a length, I can just say how long it takes light to cross it. Okay? So that reduces the number of independent units from length and time to just length, because there's a parameter, the speed of light, that allows me to convert between them. Okay. So similarly, between so we can have position. We can have position over C to be a time. We can have energy. We can have momentum, and so this allows us to reduce everything. This allows us to measure times in units of distance in units of time, energy in units of mass, momentum in units of mass, or vice versa. Okay. So of the three units that we're normally used to talking about, mass, time, and distance, this lets us get rid of two of them. Right? Let us get rid of one of them. For example, distance I can now replace by now having mass and time, let's say. Now, h bar lets me do the same thing, get rid of one more parameter. For example, given a mass, I can make given any momentum, I can make a distance using h bar over a momentum is a distance. Okay. So that means that I can quote a distance scale in terms of a momentum scale. Now, we've already seen that momenta can be related to masses. So I can also write this as h bar over mc is a distance scale. Okay? So physically, what is this? H bar over mc is the Compton wavelength of a particle of mass m. So, if I measure, so again, I can measure distances in units of something physical, the Compton wavelength of a particle, some given particle of mass m. Okay? So this lets me move. Before I had kilograms, before I had things, units of mass, length, and time. Now, by working in units where c equals 1 and h bar equals 1, I can take everything to have one of these units, any one of them that I wish. Okay. So as a high energy physicist, often we'll use mass or energy. All right. So everything will have units of energy, let's say. And let me pick a particularly convenient unit of energy. Okay. I'll use when I talk about energies, I will measure them in GeV, which is 10 to the 9 electron volts, a giga electron volt. Okay? Now, why this particular energy and not any other energy? Really just because of a happy accident. Okay? The happy accident is that the mass of the proton is almost 1 GeV. Okay? The mass of the proton, I forget what it is. Does anyone remember exactly what it is? Yeah, it's 0.938 GeV. Okay. So this symbol will make a very frequent occurrence in these set of lectures. Squiggle. Okay. I will occasionally use that symbol, but only when I'm very, very, very sure of something. You know. So even that, I will. Okay. So m proton is about 1 GeV. Well, really, it's one GeV per C squared, right? But again, we're putting C equals to one. So the units, so the MC squared of the proton is about one GeV. So that means when you measure mass in GeV, it's immediately giving you some information. It's telling you how many protons the thing is made of. That's pretty cool. Like, the mass of the sun is 10 to the 57 GeV. If you remember, it's 10 to the 33 kilograms. Then all you know is, you know, how many of whatever the thing in Paris fits in the sun, okay? But if you remember, the 10 to the 57 GeV, you have a really nice additional physical piece of information. The sun is made out of 10 to the 57 atoms, 10 to the 57 protons and electrons. Okay? So those are the units that I will use, all right? And let me just translate these units to units that you're familiar with. And this should be in the, this should really be like, if you're not used to doing this, just go do it for everything that you're familiar with tonight, and you'll start getting comfortable with it, okay? Because you'll never have to remember any other units in your life. And you'll just, I mean, it's a little perverse, but you'll really start thinking of everything in GeV. Okay, so let me just record some familiar units. So one GeV, so, okay, we said this is a unit of energy, so it's, yes.
I'm just wondering, can we get different natural units if we said the gravitational?
Yes, yes, so we'll talk about that in a second. So this is what got Planck really excited, is that if you use Newton's constant, then you nail everything, okay? Then there's no units left, and everything is a dimensionless ratio of things to these natural units, okay? So we'll talk about that. There's not much to talk about. It's just a question of using another thing as a natural unit of mass. Instead of one GeV, you can use the Planck mass, 10 to the 19 GeV, as another natural unit. I use this one because this is the one that you'll more often end up using in thinking about the universe we actually live in, okay? And it's a nice, happy in-between place. That tells you directly, as I said, physical information about what things are made of. It's just very easy to remember and get a good feeling for all kinds of important basic facts about the world around us. Of course, you're free to translate back and forth to Planck units whenever you want. Okay, so one GeV, as we said, is 10 to the 9 electron volts. That's what it is as a unit of energy. Okay. We said it's the rest mass of the proton. Okay. Now, let's get lengths and distances out of it. So how do I get a length or a distance out of this? A length or a distance is measured in units of inverse GeV, right? So a centimeter, a nice human length scale, is 10 to the 14 inverse GeV. What about a second? A second is about 10 to the 10 centimeters. 3 10 to the 10 centimeters, but threes are in the squiggle. Okay. So this is around 10 to the 24 GeV inverse. Okay. So I could say that this is 1.5 meters tall, or I can say it's 10 to the 16 GeV inverse. Okay, and that's nice because it tells me I'd stack 10 to the 16's protons end to end, and I would get as tall as the blackboard. Right? Like I said, the mass of the sun is 10 to the 57 GeV. So I didn't tell you kilogram. Right, 1 kilogram. And this is perverse, but I always remember what a kilogram is by remembering the mass of the sun. So it's 10 to the 33 kilograms, 10 to the 57 GeV. 57 minus 33 is what? 10 to the 34? 24. Thank you. Okay. So a kilogram is 10 to the 24 GeV. But you can think about GeVs for everything you like. All right, This means that also in our equations, though, we don't need to clutter things with C's and H-bars. Okay? So that means that doing dimensional analysis is really, really easy. Okay? And dimensional analysis, which you've always known as a great friend, is a particularly great friend because you don't have to keep track of seven different units. Oh, so let's talk about a few other units, just so you see how good this is. Like, what about units of magnetic field? What are the units of magnetic field? Yes, thank you. But what are they in? But Tesla are not their own unit, right? They're something in kilograms per blah, per blah, per blah, right? Oh, actually, very good. Let's back up a second. Ah, great. Thank you. Let's back up a second. Yes, sorry. Before I proceed, before we even get to something fancy like magnetic field, let's do some of the other units. Thank you. I was going to do this anyway. Let's talk about, but it's going to help us see how nice dimensional analysis is. Okay, so let's talk about units of things like charge, right? What is the electric potential between two bodies? Okay, the potential is E squared over R. If I'm a little more anal, I'd put a 4 pi there. Okay. That's the electrical potential. What are the units of electrical potential? What are they in the new cool units? Yeah. This is the entire idea. We're doing things intelligently now. Okay. So you know, look, you know, let's forget about what you know. You know that the potential goes like 1 over r, right? And that's not proportional to masses or anything. It's just some constant. Let's just write it down. There it is. I put the 4 pi just for fun, right? So what are the units of this object? Its units is 1 over length. The units are GeV, units of energy, right? You can say energy or GeV, you know, interchangeably. The units are energy. The units of V are, what are the units of V? It's an energy. It's a potential energy, right? So V is potential energy. 1 over R is already energy. So that tells you something. What is E squared over 4 pi? It's dimensionless. That's fantastic. There's an actual number there. Isn't that amazing? There's an actual pure dimensionless number that gives you the strength between, that characterizes the strength of electromagnetism, of the electric potential between two objects. Now, when we normally write this, there's a K, there's a mu naught, there's an epsilon naught, there's all kinds of crap, but you don't need that crap. Okay? This is actually true. The actual force between two objects is some number divided by 1 over R, an actual number. What is the name of that number? It's the fine structure constant. Now, when you put h bars and c's, this is e squared over 4 pi h bar c or something like that, okay? But in these intelligent units, it's an actual, just a number. And the number is around 1 over 137. Okay? Now, this is a deep and very cool fact. We've just learned something. We've learned that the strength of the electromagnetic force is characterized by a small dimensionless number. That's actually rather extraordinary. It could have been any number. It could have been 50, right? But it isn't. It's a small number. So whenever there's a small dimensionless parameter, this is one of the rules in life, when you can, when in doubt, Taylor expand. Okay? Whenever there's some small parameter, it tells you that your mind should immediately be drawn to extremes. You should always go to an extreme if something is small where it's zero, if something is big where it goes to infinity. Or always invert it. You can always, if something is big, you can look at 1 over it and talk about something small. Okay? And so this is one of the skills, one of the things that becomes part of the culture of a theoretical physicist is thinking parametrically, figuring out what the important dimensionless ratios are, what the important dimensionless constants are, and going to limits to try to understand things. I'm not going to obsess about that at length here, but we just discovered something cool with these little units, that electromagnetism is actually governed. It's a weak force. Okay, it's weak in the sense that it's the dimensionless characterization of its strength is by a small number. Okay, so charge has no units. Instead, there's this actual small parameter, which is 1 over 137 alpha. Okay, now let's keep going. What about gravity? Oh, sorry. So let me ask the other question then. What about Tesla? What about B fields? Let's do an electric field. Okay, what is an electric field? What are the units of electric field? That's not quite right. GV squared. Okay, because the units of electric field are. Should I do this in real time and embarrass myself? Force equals. Oh, right. What are the units of force? Yeah, good. Let's back up. What are the units of force? Okay, force is mass times acceleration. This is a hard way of doing it. Okay, acceleration. This is distance over time squared. Right. So this whole thing has units of mass times 1 over distance, which is mass. So force has units of mass squared. Okay. Acceleration has units of mass. Force has units of mass squared. So what are the units of electric field? GV squared, exactly. Units of electric field are GV squared. Units of magnetic field are GV squared. Okay, everything with C is set to 1. Okay. So now, let me tell you again what are some of the okay. So we've done some of the familiar guys now. Let me just mention something quickly, which this way of parametric way of thinking about things is going to help us understand a lot. Why are magnetic forces small? Why are magnetic forces small compared to electric forces? Right, because charged particles typically are moving around with small velocity. What is the typical velocity of charged particles in this table? Anywhere. What's the typical velocity of a charged particle in an atom? Well, it's a small number, but what it is, so a velocity is, a velocity in our units is what, by the way? Huh? What are the units of velocity? No, it's dimensionless. It's dimensionless. Units are dimensionless. Okay. So as it turns out, and this is something that you'll be able to understand in a very few lines if you don't understand already. In fact, the typical velocity of particles in matter is alpha. Okay. So the reason why, so this is a wonderful fact, right? You know, again, we're seeing how these few dimensionless parameters control everything in nature. So the strength of magnetic forces is down by the small factor of alpha compared to the strength of electric forces. Okay. Okay. Anyway, so that's a tour of some of the. So let's finally do the last thing that I was going to talk about, which is gravity. Okay. What are the So let's do the same formula as we did before for gravity. So this is G Newton mm over R. Okay. So what are the units of G Newton? The units of G Newton are 1 over GeV squared. Okay. Or length squared. I can say it any way that I want. Right? Now this is fascinating. Because it tells us that while the strength of electromagnetism is just a small dimensionless number, so you can say the words electromagnetism is weak, and it's a meaningful statement because it's just a dimensionless constant that's small. G Newton has units. Okay, that means there's no invariant sense in which gravity is weak or strong. It's a relative question. Okay. So let's actually figure out what G Newton is. We just said that it has units of 1 over mass squared. So let me write it in a variety of ways. So G Newton is around 1 over 10 to the 19 GeV squared. Okay. We'll often talk about M Planck to be around 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay. So that's called the Planck mass. So this is 1 over M Planck squared. Sorry, I'm just rewriting it. I can also write it as a distance. It's also 10 to the minus 33 centimeters squared. Okay, so that's L Planck is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, or 10 to the minus 43 seconds squared. That's T Planck is 10 to the minus 43 seconds. Okay? So G Newton is dimensionful. And so saying that gravity is weak or strong is actually a meaningless statement without specifying something more about the setup. Okay? But it's clear from the fact that it has units of length that at distances that are large compared to 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, gravity is a weak force. Okay? At energies that are less than 10 to the 19 GeV, gravity is a weak force. So let's get an idea. What is the dimensionless strength of gravity if we're talking about banging particles into each other at energies of order E? Okay? Well, we can get an idea. It's G Newton times the energy squared. That's a dimensionless quantity. Okay? G Newton times energy squared is a nice dimensionless quantity. And so that's a tiny number compared to 1 over 137, okay? Until the energies get to about 1/10 M Planck. And around 1/10 M Planck, it's comparable in strength to electromagnetism. So really, when we say gravity catches up with all the other forces of the Planck length, actually it catches up a little earlier than the Planck length because the other interactions are a little bit weak. Okay, so it's really at a 1/10 of the Planck length that it starts, 10 times the Planck length that it starts catching up with everything else. So this is a dimensionless. This is the dimensionless strength of gravity at energy E. Okay. Okay. So far I've introduced of the gross long-distance interactions that we've seen in the world, we've talked about all of them in these units. So gravity and electromagnetism. So let me summarize. So we've talked about one mass scale, which is the mass of the proton. Okay, so that's about a GeV. We just talked about G Newton, which is 1 over M Planck squared. With M Planck being around 10 to the 19 GeV. By the way, this is what this guy was talking about before. Since we know that this is another important scale, that we know that G Newton is another fundamental constant, instead of using GeVs, I could use M Plancks. I could measure things in units of M Planck if I like. Okay? And if you're a purely short-distance gravitational physicist, then that's a very natural thing to do. But if you want to talk about atoms and molecules and or even protons and neutrons and a lot of the rest of the world, it's more convenient to work with GeVs just because things are made out of protons. Okay, so all right. We saw that alpha is a dimensionless number. It's around 1 over 137. Actually, there's just two more important constants. Just two more important things. And when I say important, they're important just for governing the long distance, most of the gross properties of the universe. That's the mass of the electron and the mass of the pion. Okay, I'll just leave that there. Okay, so the mass of the electron is around 10 to the minus 3 GeV, around 1,000 times lighter than the proton. The mass of the pion is around 1/10 of a GeV. Okay. These things are important because, and we'll discuss this, the mass of the electron is largely responsible for chemistry in combinations with alpha for setting many of the gross properties, sizes of atoms and a lot of the gross properties of chemistry. And the pion is important only in that that length scale, the 1 over m pi, so around 10 to the minus 13 centimeters, is what's setting the typical length scale of the nuclear interactions, and is therefore responsible for holding nuclei together and a lot of the gross properties of nuclear physics. Okay? But it's really a remarkable fact that everything that I talked about that was in between these hashes, okay, more or less everything that you'd care about in everyday life, together with many things that you don't care about in everyday life, okay, every single one of those things, every phenomenon, every question that you care to ask, certainly at a gross level, every single thing can be reduced to these constants. Okay? Every single one can be reduced to these constants, and you should learn and understand how to do that, and we'll talk about how to do that. Okay. Okay. So as I said, I'm going to come back to giving you a tour of all of physics and reducing everything down to these parameters in some of the rest of the lectures. But this, remember, was a little coda while we introduced the units that we're going to be using for all these lectures. So let's go back to the main topic of this first lecture, which is telling you about these crises that are supposedly infecting our beautiful understanding of the universe. Anyway, before I proceed, any questions about this? For how many of people was this some total review? Okay, great. So if you don't, if you are not comfortable with these units, really go home tonight and convert everything in sight to GEVs. Just get happy with it, right? The mass of the bus, you know, your energy running, you know, just convert everything to these units, and it'll do some good. I'd like it so much. So yes, go ahead.
Sometimes you have like these scale factors like alpha, and sometimes you get the Boltzmann constant until the unit will become nothing.
What is Boltzmann's constant?
Yes.
Oh, very good. So let's keep going. I'm sorry. Thanks for continuing to remind me. Yeah. So let's really finish everything. Temperature. What are the units of temperature? Energy. Right. Temperature is equal to energy. So really, this is one of the real beauties of thinking this way. You don't have to remember any of those things ever again. You don't have to remember K. You have to remember certainly not. Anyway, everything is just in everything's in these units. So units of temperature is energy. Let's do pressure. What are the units of pressure? See that very good. Okay. What else? Huh? What are the units of pressure in these units? Which is? Now, you see, that's a beautiful thing. So it's GV to the fourth. It's true, it is GV to the fourth. But it shows you also something deeper about pressure than what you remember from high school. One way of talking about pressure is force per area. That's how you first learn about it. But there's something deeper about it. Okay, the fact that it goes like GV to the fourth, or 1 over length to the fourth, tells you that pressure is a property of space-time. Pressure is something which is a property of something per unit volume per unit time. Okay? And if you think about it, well, that's even if you convert your standard high school, of course, it has the right units. But that's the way pressure really fundamentally enters. Pressure is a property of energy per volume, is another way of saying it. Okay? So energy per volume is also something that looks like has the same units, right? GeV divided by 1 over GeV cubed. Okay? But that energy per volume is a more fundamental way of thinking about it. Pressure is actually an extensive property of space-time. Yes? So again, everything is in the end some. Everything is a dimensionless thing. When we give pressure in GeV. We are really giving the ratio of one pressure to another pressure. Okay, so let me illustrate the power of this way of thinking, just so it becomes just so you see how much more powerful dimensional analysis is when you're equipped with these units. Let me ask you a question to see how many before any of this would know off the top of your head what is the pressure in a neutron star. Sitting smack in the middle of a neutron star, what is the pressure? It beats me in Pascal, right? But now think, what is the pressure inside a neutron star? What is a neutron star made out of? Neutrons, right. Now, so you're in the middle of the neutron star. Is there anything you look around other than neutrons? No. Neutrons as far as the eye can see, right? So what should the pressure of the neutron star be? There's no other units other than the units associated with the neutron, which is more or less the same as the proton. So the pressure inside a neutron star is GV to the fourth. Wonderful, right? You can then go convert to Pascal later if you want. But you know the answer, right? That's the power of natural units, is that it, especially in situations where there aren't many different scales involved, you just know the answer. The pressure is GV to the fourth, and it's true. Okay. Now, actually, you could have asked a better question, which is, that's a little stupid. After all, you know, other things are made out of neutrons. So there's something special about a neutron star, of course, which is that the gravity is pulling it together until such a point that its internal pressure is balancing the gravitational pressure. But that, of course, happens, you know, that happens when everything is close packed together. And that's why there's no other scales involved, and that's the only other answer. You might have thought that there's also G Newton and the size of the neutron star. But in fact, the neutron star arranges itself in precisely such a way to balance the gravitational force deep in the middle of the neutron star. As we said, it's just neutrons as far as the eye can see, all closely packed together. There aren't two scales, so all the answer could be is GV to the fourth. So in answer to your question, when we measure some other pressure in units of GV to the fourth, we're measuring the ratio of the pressure to the ratio of pressure inside a neutron star. Okay? That's a nice way of thinking about what it is. Okay? So it's always a dimensionless thing. Everything is always a dimensionless thing. Okay? Yes?
So you have like pressure in space-time volume, it's like dimensionless something for space-time volume. Is it like implied that dimensionless something is a count, or are there other like things that can be done?
Well, let's talk about the
because you have to give me the units of the space-time volume, right? So if we say it's GeV to the fourth, then it's one GeV in an inverse GeV cubes of volume, right? That's what the pressure is. What about mass density? What's mass density in these units? GeV to the fourth again, right? GeV to the fourth again. So just to do another example like this. So let's say you have some material which has some mass density and some pressure, right? So if you kick that material, you're going to send some wave going through it. What's the velocity of the wave? Is it one? Is it always one? So let's actually ask a question for which it is one. What's the velocity of sound waves inside a neutron star? What else could it be, right? so it's really a wonderful thing, right? That there's a, it's one. It's basically one. Now, it's actually not exactly one. Yeah, the speed of light. Now, it's not exactly one. And so this kind of argument isn't going to give you order one factors, okay? In fact, the typical velocity in a neutron star is one over root three. But it's of order one. And because what else could it be? There's no other scales. Then so we're done. You work in natural units, you immediately get the right answer to questions like this. Okay? However, let's take a typical material. It's not one. Let me remind you of a simple analog situation, which is the famous piece of string, thank you, between some mass density and some tension, right? There's a tension and there's some mass density. And so you guys all remember this formula that the speed of sound squared is tension over mu, right? Okay. Now, this is how you could have figured that it had to be tension over mu just without doing anything. The units of tension and the units of mu are the same thing. What are the units of tension? What are the units of tension of the string? GeV squared. See, isn't this beautiful? It's GeV squared because it's a one-dimensional object. It's GeV to the fourth when you're talking about pressure in some volume. If you had a membrane, what are the units of surface tension? GeV cubed, because it's a two-dimensional surface. Okay, all right. So, okay. And this is the only dimensionless ratio that you can have, right? So there is a dimensionless ratio of these two things of units GeV to the fourth, or in this case GeV squared. And that sets something dimensionless, which is this, which is the speed of the material, which is the speed of sound through the material. Okay. So I think that completes. If there are any other units that you're familiar with that you want to talk about, go ahead.
Because you get this T over mu, which is dimensionless,
yes.
And then why would it be the square of the speed of sound?
Oh, very good. Very good. So this is another, well, so of course some of these things you have to actually do, right? however, there are some important principles which are slightly more sophisticated. Ask me this question a little bit later, okay? But one reason it's a little more obvious if you think about it. In the general case, let's say in three dimensions. Okay, so in three dimensions, we would say that the speed of sound squared is what? What is the analog of this?
P over rho,
right? P over rho. But you see, this makes it a little obvious why it has to be b squared. Because you can't have a formula that says v is equal to p over rho. Which component of v? In what direction? Okay, it's a vector. Okay, so you have to have a scalar. You know, you have to have a formula for some scalar made out of the vector. Of course, you could say, why isn't the square root of velocity squared? Okay. However, this is a general rule in physics, and it's not 100% true all the time. It's a general rule that the formulas are analytic. If you have, you should not have funny. This is really not bullshit, but it'll take a little longer to explain it. Okay, so in this case, you can actually do it as well. It's not so hard. All right, very good. But really, things should be analytic. Let me say it another way. If you have square roots or funny non-analytic things, there's always something to explain. You should always understand where non-analyticities in your formula come from. Unless otherwise mandated by some reason, formulas should be analytic. This is actually a quite key principle, which can save your ass many, many times as well. Yes,
sorry. Are you using the word?
Analytic in the sense of truly analytic in the sense of complex functions. Okay. So they shouldn't be they shouldn't have branch cuts in the complex plane.
Okay.
But this is really taking things quite far afield. What velocities here have to do with the complex plane? There really is. There really are related to each other. Yeah. This is really all the super duper sophistication for something that I think many of us learned a long time ago. So, yes. Any other questions? Yeah.
Information and natural units.
Oh, great. Dimensionless.
Well, okay. I was just wondering because there's conventions like bits or nits or how did.
But they're just numbers, right? They're just numbers. So information is dimensionless. Entropy, what do we use for entropy?
Dimensionless.
What do we use for entropy density? GV cubed. Okay. So are we done? Yes.
So my original question was, how do you know when you put in numerical practice
That depends on physics. Of course you have to understand physics.
We'll talk about that a lot. So when there are small numbers around, you have to figure out how the small numbers are going to enter any formula. Okay, I did the neutron star as a nice example because it happens to be a case where there's no small parameters. The strength is as strong for it. You know, everything is packed. There's no big or small parameters. I'm not saying this is a panacea and you don't have to do physics anymore just by using the right units. I am saying that using the right units and using these units lets you remove all of the irrelevant clutter so you're only focusing on the important physical issues. Okay, it's not a big deal, but it's worth knowing and getting familiar with. Okay, all right. So let's return to our highbrow discussion and go back to that picture of all the scales. What time is it, by the way? 20 to 11. Okay. How in general do you guys want to do this? Should we go 3 hours straight every day? Do we have a break in the middle? How does it work? Is there a break? Do you want to have a break now? Or should we have a break now? Why don't we have a break now and then we'll come back?